Are you enjoying the Single Tracks podcast? Well, we could use your support. The small but dedicated Single Tracks team works hard to share the mountain bike information that inspires epic adventures. Through this podcast, our worldwide database of trail maps and photos, and daily news and reviews on the website. So consider becoming a monthly, annual, or lifetime pro supporter and enjoy ad-free browsing on the website, free Single Tracks stickers in the mail, and discounts on merch for as little as $3 per month. Go to singletracks.com/support to sign up and to find out other ways you can help support our mission. That's singletracks.com/support. Thank you and happy trails. Hey everybody, welcome to the Single Tracks podcast. My name is Jeff, and today my guest is Rab Wardell. So Rab is a mountain bike athlete and coach living in Glasgow, Scotland. He recently set the fastest known time on the West Highland Way, which is a 96-mile off-road route connecting, I'm not going to say it right, Milligeneve and Fort William. What is it? Correct me, Rab.
We've definitely Scottished you here. It's actually pronounced Mulgai.
Mulgai. It looks nothing like that. I'm going to have to put that in the show notes.
Scottish people get that one wrong all the time. If you've never, it's one of those, it's one that'll always catch you out. Nobody can figure out how to say that from reading that. So right, Mulgai.
Okay, good. I don't feel as bad. Well, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you very much.
So tell us a bit about your background. How'd you get into cycling?
I've ridden a bike since I was a child, but I wouldn't classify myself as a cyclist until I was a teenager, probably. So I got into cycling through mountain biking. We were on a family holiday in the Highlands in a place called Aviemore, and we hired bikes and went for an explore in the forests, just north of Aviemore, and that was the first ride I ever did. I wasn't instantly hooked. My older brother David actually was the really passionate one of us when we were teenagers, and he bought a mountain bike from a local bike shop, which had a great cycling club. Associated to a great mountain bike cycling club, so it's Sandy Wallace Cycles. It's a fairly well known club in Scotland for sure. And he basically just was immersed in mountain biking to start with, and really got into it in a big way. And started racing the Scottish mountain bike series, and even raced the British series as well the following year. I kind of followed him into it and started riding, and we would go away as a family, and the whole family would go away, and we'd ride in Scottish and British mountain bike series races, and the club, we'd ride like twice a week with the club, and every evening after school would be out kind of riding the streets. And I grew up in a small town, wasn't necessarily in the mountains, so we used to ride kind of straight and ride down steps and all kinds of daft stuff. Right. Big kind of fan of trials riding. So when we were teenagers, Martin Ashton and Martin Hawes were two big names who appeared in MBUK a lot of the time. Hans Ray as well, Ryan Leach, and these guys were riding. So we would ride our cross country bikes, like trials bikes, when we couldn't ride in the forests or in the hills. And then when we could, we would, generally be riding with the club and traveling around Scotland to the different riding spots.
Yeah, cool. Well, you've competed in a number of different cycling race formats. What makes this, fastest known time, people call it the FKT, what makes that different from other types of races?
I think one of the draws is the fact that you can set your own challenge. You don't have, if you're competing in other events or race formats, you have to go to the race. You need to have a race organized. You need to have people to compete against. Whereas with an FKT, you can effectively you could even make up your own route and just see how you're gonna go. And it's you're really just competing against yourself more than anything, and trying to conquer the trail. So I think that's what really drew me to it this year was, you know, it's been a challenging year. In the UK, pretty much every mountain bike event and most cycling events were cancelled or postponed due to COVID. It was an outlet for me to kind of set a goal, set a challenge, and try and complete that, and basically try and better myself and just see what I was capable of this year, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, is it like lower pressure too in some ways? Like, you know, because you kind of set like when you're ready to do it. You don't have to like optimize your training for like this specific date. You can kind of just wait and be like, okay, I'm ready now. I'm going to do it. And there's not people there to like see you, you know, kind of on your own. And heck, if you don't set the FKT, maybe you don't even tell anybody, right? You wait until you do break it. So is there like less pressure in that situation, or are there like different kinds of pressures that you face?
Well, in theory, all the points you make are valid, but in my case, I opened my big mouth and decided to make a film about it. So
yeah.
It was working with Wahoo and Santa Cruz Bikes and a few other partners, and we decided to document the attempt and the ride, which added so much pressure, you know, so much unnecessary pressure, you know. But it was fantastic to be making a document and the ride and the film, and the film was really more about mountain biking the West Highland Way rather than me going for an FKT. But I think in theory, yes, being able to, you know, just set a route and have an attempt when you feel good and have your, you know, when the conditions are good.
Yeah, weather.
I think that's really as a, you know, a draw for doing an FKT or just setting your own time on a particular trail. But in this instance, we did have to set a date. We did have to, you know, I had to target my training towards it, and a lot of the pressure that you would associate with a typical race was there for sure. It felt really high pressure going into it. Actually, I was really, really stressed out, but thankfully was able to do the job.
Yeah. Well, I guess too, a big difference is that you don't see the people that you're racing against, right? I mean, I guess you have the clock. And so is that kind of what you're paying attention to the whole time, is like, you know, the time that you need to hit along the way, and that's kind of where you're competing against the clock versus against, you know, other people in the field?
Yeah. So, I mean, you don't have to react to other riders or other racers. And I guess it's not really about winning and losing in that kind of way, but I was aware of what schedule I needed to stick to, if you like, and my schedule changed with only a few weeks before I planned to go for my attempt, when the record was broken.
Right,
you know, it was broken about 6 weeks before. A record that had stood for 4.5 years was broken just before I decided to make, or I was planning to make my attempt. So it was a guy called Gary McDonald, who's from Fort William. He's a really great all-round cyclist.
Did you have any idea that he was going to attempt it?
Yeah, I had heard that he was planning it. I didn't know that he was going to do it at that time. But I think, you know, you've seen, or it has been seen that in the kind of FKT attempts and records have just been, there's been so many this year because of the events being cancelled due to coronavirus and COVID, and so it kind of blessed a lot of people with a bit of time to be able to actually target something different. I think a lot of riders normally wouldn't do something like this because it maybe conflicts with their race season or what they had planned, what they would normally be doing. So when you've got we had quite tight restrictions, with our lockdown earlier in the year, and then around about June that the restrictions started to ease, and you had a lot of fit people and who are motivated to try and do something. And I think that's why, you know, what really you kind of I guess, motivated Gary to set his time. It's the same motivation I had, really. I was feeling fit, and I was feeling fitter than I have been for a number of years. And, you know, this opportunity was there. So I think that's why he went for it then.
Yeah. Well, why did you set your sights on the West Highland Way in particular for your FKT attempt? What is it about that route that's special to you, or why do you enjoy it?
Yeah, that's a good question. I've walked and ridden on the West Highland Way a number of times over the last, maybe 12 or 13 years. So I walked it over 6 days, 2007, I think it was. And when I was walking, I just couldn't believe what a great journey it was, you know, to go from the big city to the outdoor capital of the UK and, you know, Fort William and Lough Arbour, to kind of travel into the highlands, and the mountains just get big. You know, we've only got little mountains, but they get bigger and bigger as you make your way north. And I just thought this would be a fantastic bike ride. And, you know, a few years later, I came back to mountain bike, and I didn't know anyone who had ridden the whole way when I did that. And that was in 2000, and I think it was 2011 that I did that. And yeah, I just rode it to see if I could, and I did it once more after that, and it's just a fantastic route. You know, it's iconic. You know, it's really well known, really well known by walkers and cyclists, not just in Scotland and the UK, but from, you know, the world over, and it's one of those challenges, I think. I really like as a mountain biker, when somebody finds out that you've mountain biked from Mulgay to Fort William on the West Highland Way, that, you know, most walkers are in disbelief. Or when you meet people on the route, they're, you know, you have a bit of chat and they say, oh, so where are you off to? And you go, well, I'm going to Fort William. And they're like, oh, where did you start? And you go, started in Mulgay. And they just, you know, they kind of can't get their head around it. So people seem to like that. And yeah, I think that's what draws me to it, is a fantastic adventure.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's crazy to think too, that, you know, it took you almost a week to walk it, and then to be able to bike it all in one go. That's pretty exciting and impressive. So how long did you prepare for this attempt, and what did your preparation look like?
I guess there's two answers to this question a little bit, because I ride all the time. I've been riding, you know, even when I'm not training for something, I ride my bike. So I think I've got a reasonable level of fitness kind of year round, and have done for most of my adult life. But my real preparation, I would say, I think when we had our lockdown in the UK, which I think would have been around about March, I'd been training quite well through the winter. I'd been racing on the velodrome, and I'd been riding fairly consistently, and I just got a kind of pain cave set up in our new house. I'd been starting to get a bit fitter, and then we had lockdown. And my girlfriend and I, my girlfriend's name's Katie Archibald. She's a professional track cyclist. Yeah. So she was training in towards Tokyo Olympics, which was yet to be postponed. But she's a full-time professional athlete. So she and I just, or I just tagged along with her, and we started training a lot more when we were kind of blessed with this time. So, you know, March into June, I was getting really fit. And then as I pitched the idea to set a record attempt on the West Highland Way, and got, you know, secured the support from Wahoo and Santa Cruz, and that really, I guess, I kind of leveled up my preparation and my training at that point. So that would have been maybe June into September. So how long it take me to prepare, I guess, when, you know,
your whole preparing life, all in, sounds like.
Yeah, preparing all in was 3 months. But yeah, it's kind of, I guess, I've kind of been doing this kind of stuff all for a long time, 20 years. There we are. There's two answers. There's either 20 years or 3 months. Pick whichever one you like.
Right, Right. But so, yeah, once you did decide, like, I'm going to go for this, like, what did that preparation look like? Was it, did you change sort of your fitness routine, like what you were doing to work out? Or did you also look at your bike and like, how am I going to, you know, set up my bike for this?
Yeah, yeah. So initially, the first month or so was a lot of time on a road bike. Mm-hmm. So just starting to get the riding time up. So I actually did my longest ever bike ride. At that point, I did 270K, which is about 165 miles road ride over about, I think it took me about 9 hours to ride that. So it was, you know, I basically was starting to get the riding time up, mm-hmm. just to know that I could actually survive your riding for the time that was aiming for it, the kind of power that I was expecting.
Yeah.
So a good bunch of time on the road bike initially, and then I transferred that to the mountain bike a little more, and did some longer rides on the West Island Way. Did a little bit of recceing and making sure that I felt confident, you know, knowing where the route went and which sections I could ride and which sections I knew that I would have to kind of get off. Mm-hmm. And also did I maintained like probably twice a week, like a gym session. So a bit of mobility. I wasn't doing any real heavy lifting at that point, but it was just, regular gym training to make sure that I was, you know, mobile and balanced and basically healthy. And then specific sessions were done on the kicker indoors. So interval training, kind of VO2 max sessions, or I was doing some fasted sessions as well. So, or low carbohydrate sessions where I would set a right at what I would call my fat max intensity. And just, you know, just really aim to be as fat adapted as possible for doing the ride. So there was a lot going on in terms of specific sessions. I think the key ones I would really focus on were the longer rides to give me the confidence to know that I could ride the distance fast enough.
Yeah, cool. Well, what was your bike setup like for the attempt? I mean, obviously you'd have to bring all your fuel and hydration with you. Yeah. What kind of bike were you riding and what did you bring along?
Yeah, so I took most of my fuel, like most of my gels and food and that kind of stuff with me, but I was actually getting bottle hand-ups. So the previous record times that have been set on the West Island Way have been supported in that way. So I kind of stuck to that, although a lot of FKTs are self-supported or unsupported.
Yeah.
And that's something that I'm keen on doing in the future. But on this attempt, I stuck to the status quo and had bottle hand-ups. But I had my bike, I spent a lot of time looking into it. So I rode a full suspension cross-country bike, 100 millimeters of travel on the rear and 110 millimeters of travel on the fork. It's a Santa Cruz blur frame, so super lightweight, carbon wheels as well, so kind of Santa Cruz Reserve carbon wheels on Industry 9 hubs. I ran a dropper post, which was for me was a big change from what I've previously done.
Yeah.
So it was quite a long travel dropper post as well. You know, if you look at cross country standards, most people run fairly short dropper posts, and I had a 125 millimeter drop.
Oh.
RockShox Reverb. I had a really, yeah, it was a dream bike to ride. I had a, you know, SRAM Axis electric wireless shifting disc brakes, RockShox suspension and Reverb post.
Yeah.
And the tires, I was using something called Cushcore.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Good flat protection, I guess, for an attempt like that. Did you have any flats along the way?
I did. Yeah. I had a puncture dropping into Kinloch Leven. And I actually had a long way to ride until I could collect a spare wheel. So again, we had some mechanical support along the way as well as bottles. Again, sticking to the status quo from previous records. So, but no, I had to ride for about 6K down a really rocky gravel road into Kinloch Leven. And you know, without the Cushcore, there's no way that the wheels would have survived. So,
you left it no pressure, but you had the Cushcores in.
Yeah, yeah.
And just rode it out.
I just rode the flat tire all the way to the bottom, and it's seriously rough. The other thing with the Cush Core that I like is that you can run lower tire pressures, and so the feel of the tire feels a lot. It feels nicer. Mm-hmm. So you can run a bit softer tire. It kind of takes out a lot of the bumps and the trail vibration, which is really good for reducing fatigue over time. That's one of the things. Some people might look at the West Island Way and say, maybe I'll ride it on a gravel bike or a hardtail cross-country bike with a seat up. But you just get shook up and almost beaten up. Yeah. And it really adds to the fatigue. So that's why I really wanted a full suspension bike with Cush Core set up. And I ran quite high volume, super fast, but high volume tires as well from Continental.
Yeah, it seems like the lower pressure too would add some resistance for you, but I guess it was worth that trade-off.
Yeah, I don't exactly know the science of this, but as from what I can gather, it doesn't really add any drag. You know, I think there's been a lot of, I'm not really sure with this idea of higher pressure and harder tires going faster.
Seems to work for road bikes, right? But yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of does, but I think people are running a lot softer tires than they used to on road bikes, and they're riding a lot bigger tires now. So
true.
You know, especially if you look at something like Roubaix, with the pros like Paris-Roubaix, they run like super soft tires, real big fat tires, and at crazy low pressures, and they still roll pretty well. I think if you have really good tarmac, like really good pavement and super smooth surfaces, riding a hard tire can work okay. Like on the velodrome as well, like you would ride hard tires, but. I don't think it make you know, if we're talking from the difference of 30 PSI to, you know, 18 PSI, I think a lot of the time it's because the roughness of the trail, it's actually slower to go too hard. Hmm. And I think that can even translate to the road as well. If you've got any rough sections of tarmac, if I think about what we used to race on when, you know, in like early 2000s, you would have you'd almost wanted your road tires to be as narrow as possible and as hard as possible. Mm-hmm. And it seems to be going completely the opposite way. So people are racing on 28 mil tires at 90 PSI.
Right. Bouncing around, I guess, on higher pressures, and, you know, you're losing traction that way. So you're gonna lose it either way, I guess. And you might as well be comfortable.
For sure. Yeah. And I mean, like I say, I don't know the science. I don't have a good enough reason for it. But the main reason was, for me, it felt faster and it felt better. I liked it.
Yeah. Well, it worked. It worked. So to me, that you're right. It's got to be right.
Yeah. Always learning.
Yeah. So what was the most challenging part for you during the ride?
The most challenging part, without a doubt, was after the puncture. Riding out of Kinlochleven. There had been some other challenging parts beforehand, so the weather conditions weren't ideal, and I had a really long section of headwind, about 2 hours where I was riding into a headwind. Oof. which had a big effect on the time, you know. So mm-hmm. Like I say, I was riding to a schedule. I was ahead of the schedule, which was reassuring. Mm-hmm. But you know, I knew that I wasn't taking, you know, taking the time that I was hoping to mm-hmm. be able to do. And my big goal beforehand was to just, you know, I kind of just wanted to do this once and do it really, really well and set a time that I thought was like a real representation of how fast can I do this. Mm-hmm. So it was getting into my head a little bit, the fact that this headwind was having an impact on my time.
Yeah.
And then to puncture, you obviously took a lot of time off again. So I was in a bit of a negative headspace riding out of Kinlochleven. Was also very, very anxious about puncturing again. You know, it's called the military road from Kinlochleven to Fort William, and it is big, sharp rocks. It's a double track or like a jeep track or 4x4 track, but it's, you know, the rocks are pretty big. So and you can hit some fairly high speeds on it as well. So puncturing on that is quite, you know, it's a serious possibility that would happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was anxious about puncturing again, and also dealing with the disappointment of having these mishaps and, you know, having a puncture and a headwind. I felt kind of, you know, I was in a bit of a negative mindset, and that translated to me, you know, it was just harder. So it was a big challenge. Thankfully, my support crew, that I saw them, or, you know, just before going at the final stretch to Fort William, I saw them for some fresh water, and I got a bit of a rallying speech from my friend James McCallum. He got a bit excited, and, you know, kind of encouraged me to push to the end, and that kind of pulled me back out of the depression, if you like, or the kind of the negative headspace, and I was able to finish the job off.
Yeah. Well, now that you're looking back on it, do you think you could do it again and do it faster, or are you past that? Are you like, nope, that was it? You know, because if you do it again, who knows? There could be more headwinds, or you get two flat tires.
Yeah, I think, yeah, the time will be beaten for sure. Mm. Whether or not it's by me or not, I don't know. I think if I do it again, I'll do it self-supported. I'll take my own spares, I'll take my own food and hydration, and look to set not a more legitimate, but like a self-supported FKT.
Yeah.
On that route, and I even think doing that, you know, taking my own spares and taking my own hydration and food, I think I can still break the 9:14 that I set on the day. I think sub 9 hours is definitely possible. When I was going into the day, I was even thinking something like 8:45 or,
whoa,
you know, there will be people who'll go 8.5 hours. If we kind of get into people's head and they want to try the route, you know, try and take the FKT on the West Helen Way, it definitely is beatable. And I think with good conditions and a clean run, and, you know, there are better riders than me out there, I'm sure. So it's we'll need to just wait and see what happens. But I think definitely under 9 hours is on for sure.
Yeah. Well, another challenge you've set for yourself is best described as Munro bagging. So tell us, what's a Munro and how do you bag one?
So a Munro is a mountain, a Scottish mountain that's 3,000 feet high. So the summit is over 3,000 feet or higher, so 914 meters. And yeah. So every hill of that height is called a Munro, and there's a list of Munros. And a lot of people do, you know, Munro bagging in Scotland, and we'll walk and try and tackle them all. I'm not sure exactly how many there are. Hold on. Originally, there were 283 Munros. And the list has grown and shrunk over the years, so it says. So you might have noticed that I'm reading this. No, it's the current total is 282 Munros.
Okay.
So yeah, some people will, you know, try and collect them, if you like. So that's what Munro bagging is. It's basically going to the next Munro, summiting it, and completing the list. It's like having your sticker book of Munros. So yeah, there's quite a few of them which are possible to do on bikes, and actually fairly good fun to ride. So it's always exciting to go and ride one that you've never done, or revisit one that you, or revisit a kind of past favorite. So I've done a few over the years. A friend of mine called Pete Scully, and he's always poring over his maps and looking at, you know, Google Earth, and being like, oh, this one looks amazing, and you know, I don't know anybody who's done it before, and that's normally a bad sign.
Right.
If you don't know anyone who's ridden it before, it probably means it's not going to be that great on a mountain bike. But yeah, we've done a couple in the past where we've spent more time carrying our bikes than we have riding, but it's all, at least it's ticking one off the list. So yeah, favourites I would say would be Ben Lomond is one. I think it's the furthest south Munro, actually. It's on the banks of Loch Lomond, and it's just a fantastic bike ride. And also Ben Lawers and Ben Glass, you can ride two Munros in the same loop, and it's actually not too long a ride for us to do. So and my friend Stu Thompson, who is actually the, I'm going to get this wrong, he was a production editor or director? No, I never know. I don't know the right titles. But he was working on the film. He and I rode Ben Lawrence and Bain Glass a couple of years ago in an evening in Scotland. And I think we were only riding for 2 hours and we summited two mountains. So,
oh, wow.
You can get out. And I think it actually took us longer to drive there and drive home than it did to actually ride the route. So, it's really good fun. It feels like how mountain biking used to feel when I was a kid and you were going on an adventure. You've never ridden this place before. You're kind of venturing into the unknown. And it's just exciting. And it also, I think the other thing that's exciting about it is you don't actually know how much of it you're going to be able to ride, how much is going to be too difficult to ride or if it's possible. And it's always exciting when you get one that you can ride almost the whole way. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, it sounds like a good like physical challenge and technical challenge, and then also just navigational challenge. I mean, a lot of these, just kind of picking them off the map. Aside from the Munros and the West Highland Way, obviously, do you have other favorite trails or places that you've ridden?
There's so many. I love riding new places, but one place I always go back to is again a really accessible trail near Stirling, and there's a forest called Cambus Barren, and then there's another section called North Third, which is a series of cliff tops above a reservoir, and there's three cliff tops or three crags that you ride along the tops of. Again, it's a originally a walking trail. I should add that in Scotland, our land access, we have what's called the right to roam, which means that you can walk, ride a bike, or ride a horse anywhere, effectively. So we don't have any. There's no such thing as trespassing. So we can basically go anywhere and ride anywhere as long as you're responsible. And the hierarchy really is that if you're on a bike and you approach a horse rider or a walker, you must, you know, yield and kind of slow down and give way, and that's fine with me. I'm quite happy saying hello and seeing how people are. I'm going on another tangent here, but years ago when I was doing my mountain bike leadership award, Jules Fincham said, "Your job as a mountain biker is whenever you come across a walker or a horse rider or somebody else in the outdoors, the best job you can make is just make their day a little bit better." So after you see them, you almost, yeah, I think there can often be a bad relationship sometimes. Somebody has a bad experience with a mountain biker who's, you know, done, you know, ridden too fast or not being polite. It's so easy to just say hello and ask how somebody is and just take a moment and hopefully improve their day a little bit. So I always think about that when I'm out riding, try and just represent mountain bikers and cyclists in a good way.
Yeah, and it's such a small thing, and a lot of us, I think, probably have been told that, and you know, maybe we believe it or maybe we don't, but you know, there have been plenty of examples here in the U.S. You know, with one of the recent things was at the Kingdom Trails, well-known trail location, and you know, apparently some of the landowners had just a handful, maybe one or two bad interactions with mountain bikers where the bikers were not courteous. And after that, based on that limited interaction, you know, they shut the whole thing down and said, no bikers. And so, yeah, you never know kind of what your interaction can lead to.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's something you need to be mindful of because like I say, in Scotland, we're really lucky to be able to ride almost anywhere, but it's, you know, it can become an issue if you take it for granted or you take it too far. You know, you think you can just do anything and not be challenged, things will change or have there's always a potential for things to change. So as long as we act responsibly and you know, I guess just try and do what's fair, and and be courteous. Fingers crossed we'll be able to to continue with the awesome land access that we have.
Yeah. Well, now I'm curious. I mean, were you able to do that during the FKT attempt? Were you mindful of that? Or, you know, because you hear of a lot of people, you know, what do they call them? Strava holes.
Yeah.
You know, like we get into that mode where we're like, okay, you know, I'm doing my thing and I'm trying to break my time. You know, I don't have time to be courteous, or like that guy's in my way. I got to go around him. Like, did you run into that? Was that in your mind during the attempt?
No, I tried to say hi to as many people as I could. And, you know, if it was a natural moment where we were passing at the same time, I would say hello, please, thank you. You know, there was one point where I was going over a fence, or what we call like a stile. I don't know if you would call it that, but like a step over a fence. And there was a lady in front of me that was, you know, it was quite an awkward, tricky one to walk over on quite a steep hill. And she was going before me, and, you know, let her go before me. And
you didn't yell out, "I'm in a race here. I'm trying to set the fastest."
No, I have a bit of a joke. You know, even in races, you know, if you're passing another rider who's in another race or another category, I mean, you give them a shout and you say rider, but I think a please and a thank you always goes a long way, especially if they pull off the side of the trail to let you pass. You know, it's please and a thank you is definitely the way to go. And we always laugh about the bad example of the guy, race leader coming through, or, you know, just taking themselves a little bit, you know, a little bit too seriously, you know. You know, it's some people can get a little bit too aggressive or tied up in the whole racing, you know. So no, it was I took a moment and said hello, and yeah, tried not to put any pressure on anyone. And, you know, it's, you know, I'm not saying I was perfect, but I certainly was mindful and did what I could to say hello and please and thank you to as many people as I interacted with on the trail.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, I didn't go out of my way. Like, I didn't shout like 30 meters over to somebody who was sat having a picnic.
Yeah. After you. No, after you.
Yeah. So yeah. I did try my best. Yeah, for sure.
Well, in addition to riding and competing, you're also a cycling coach. Tell us how you got into that.
I thought about being a cycling coach from a very young age. You know, when I started cycling, I was lucky to actually be a part of the Scottish National Program, Scottish National Mountain Bike Development Team, or whatever it was called at the time, and be on the receiving end of coaching from quite a young age. And when I finished school, I actually started a coaching qualification in college, which I did drop out of, but I dropped out of it to focus on my racing. And once I rode for the Scottish national team for two seasons after coming out of school, and rode the Mountain Bike World Cup series as an elite, and straight in with the big boys, so to speak. And rode an event, a pretty big event for us, called the Commonwealth Games. So it's nations like Australia, Canada, South Africa, New Zealand, England, Scotland, Wales, and a whole lot more are in the Commonwealth Games. And I competed in the Commonwealth Games in Melbourne in 2006. When I came home from that, it became fairly clear to me that it wasn't going to be a sustainable career path. I was unable to turn professional as a pro mountain biker, which was a bitter pill to swallow at the time. But the blessing was there was a new team of development coaches being employed at Scottish Cycling. So it was a completely new team, a really fresh development to try and basically develop young cyclists and increase opportunities for young people to cycle in Scotland. And I was asked to apply for a job, and applied and interviewed for it, and was, you know, thankfully secured a job as the West of Scotland development coach for Scottish Cycling at the age of 21. So, pretty young going into it. But it, you know, I think if I hadn't gotten that job, I would have, I don't know where I'd end up actually, because I'd stopped riding my bike. I was quite disappointed about the fact that I wasn't able to become a professional, and wasn't a sustainable way to live. So I was, I'd stopped racing. I hadn't ridden my bike for, 6 months, maybe longer, when this opportunity came up. And, I guess I fell in love with the sport all over again. And got back riding and coaching as well. So it was a fantastic job, and it's been really exciting to see how a lot of the riders that I worked with started coaching, just in schools or in summer holiday programs. These kind of things have stayed in the sport and gone on to to progress. It's been quite cool to see that. And yeah, my coaching career has been, it's the main way that I've sustained my hobby and my racing. So I have gone back to race World Cups. I went back to competing to ride World Cups in 2012 till 2014. And like I say, I do still race a lot. It's the racing's not the tricky bit. It's generally been the training has always been the harder bit for me to fit that in and do that well. But I balance coaching. I actually have my own coaching company now, called Wardell Cycle Coaching. It's a little plug, in there. It's a really nice balance that I have at the moment to be able to coach and also ride and potentially go back racing next year, once the races are back on.
Yeah. Well, one of the focuses of your coaching seems to be building confidence for riders of all skill levels. So are there any shortcuts to gaining confidence that you've found, or is it something that people have to sort of gain slowly over time?
I think, I wouldn't say there were shortcuts, but I think one thing that I like to think is that, I've basically made every mistake in the book over 20 years. It's all of the common mistakes I think I've been guilty of, and people are generally really guilty of these kind of common mistakes if they're eager to improve or they're ambitious. It's really easy to just almost try too hard a lot of the time, or miss some of these little the fundamental things that you can do well to improve. So one thing that I hope is that if a rider or an athlete comes to work with me, I can help them learn from my mistakes, and they can learn them a lot faster. I would say that if you work with a coach, you can make progress a lot more quickly than if you try and figure it out for yourself. But I wouldn't say there's particularly a shortcut to gaining confidence. One thing that I generally find is it's a tricky one to kind of put over, but a lot of the time, in terms of technical riding, a lot of the time slow is fast. Actually learning how to do things smoothly is probably the better way to do it. So not riding in a frantic manner, always aspiring to be composed when you're riding. So I often say that the one thing that really links a lot of top performers is composure, whether or not you're looking at someone like Lewis Hamilton racing Formula One, or Roger Federer playing tennis, or Egan Bernal riding up a mountain in the Tour de France. They generally look pretty composed, and the person that's winning generally makes it look really easy. And I think it's trying to put yourself in that place of how does it feel for that person, and how does it feel for you when you're riding? Does it feel frantic? Does it feel crazy? A rider that I worked with a few years ago, I used to work for a company called Dirt School, which is based in the Tweed Valley in Scotland, a real mountain bike hotspot. And one of the key parts of the business is working with Borders College, and they have a college course for mountain biking. It's called Borders Academy of Sport and Excellence, which is based in the Tweed Valley. And Reese Wilson was a student on that course, and maybe 5 or 6 years ago now, and he is now the UCI downhill world champion. Elite world champion, which he set in like a really, I don't know if you saw the race in Austria this year, but the conditions were insane, really, really deep mud.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
And most riders just crashed and couldn't hold together a race run. And Rhys, you know, stuck down a perfect run from top to bottom.
Yeah.
And something, you know, it was almost like did the impossible. And again, if you speak to him, he was saying that he had a fairly calm race run. From the outside, it looked crazy. But inside his helmet, it felt like composed, and he knew exactly what he was doing. So
yeah,
I think that's really easy to do, especially when if you're thinking about downhill mountain biking or enduro mountain biking. A lot of people think that they just have to go, you know, try not to be scared and go as fast as possible, and it's almost the opposite of what you should do.
Yeah, that's really good advice, and I had never thought of it that way. That instead of pursuing, you know, speed first, what a lot of people could benefit from is pursuing that composure, that calm and that confidence, and seeing where that sort of runs out, I guess, right? Like as long as you're calm and composed, then the speed is going to follow.
Yeah.
But trying to jump right to the speed, yeah, like you said, you can end up frantic and kind of all over the place.
Yeah. Speed, I say this a lot as well, like speed is a byproduct. Speed's not the objective. Speed's not, you know, anything. You do all the right things and you go fast. And it's generally going to be things like slowing down at the right places or choosing the right line or, you know, making sure that your body position is right, going into a corner or down a drop, or you know, actually even having the fundamentals of, you know, knowing how to jump or how to ride a drop off or, you know, how to corner, for example. If you can break down and learn the fundamentals and the simple parts, you know, then you just have to start piecing the jigsaw together.
Mm-hmm.
If you have an idea of how it feels to ride smoothly and you know, you can start to, you know, maybe do some timing or put a stopwatch on something or check your Strava PRs or whatever it ends up being. It's you can start to see that progression and you maybe there are points where you should ride faster, but you can try it out, and if it feels like you're going over the limit and it's starting to go feel frantic, you know that you actually need to just back that off and rein it in. So that's another thing, I guess. It's not really a shortcut to confidence, but a way to gain more confidence is to practice the right things, you know, purposeful practice, as we call it, and do it over and over and over again. There isn't really a secret. It's just repetition and just, you know, putting in the time to do it, you know.
It's not what we want to hear, but
no,
that's not what we need to hear.
You know, I think of it like my guitar teacher used to, you know, we used to always warm up with scales, or we would, you know, every lesson you start off with scales, and you'd be like, I just want to play Sweet Child of Mine, you know.
Right.
It's like, you know, I just want it, and it's yeah. Unless you can do your scales well, you're never going to play the guitar well or whatever. And yeah, it's the same as fitness training. You know, it's like you see it all over the place. Like this, you know, this one session, you know, this is the session that's going to make the difference. It's like it's probably going to just be riding your bike a lot. You know, sleeping well, eating well, riding your bike a lot, resting well. You know, is you know, there's plenty of papers out there to prove that that's going to be, you know, it's not that complicated. But the tricky bit is maintaining the motivation and keeping doing it and staying consistent over a long period of time. You know, that's the tricky bit.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you, was about fitness and the struggles that people have. And, you know, you mentioned your training for the FKT involved a lot of road biking. And I know mountain bikers, you know, we hate to hear that because it's like, no, I ride mountain bikes. I don't ride road bikes. And can't I just, you know, put in 8 hours on the mountain bike and instead of getting on the road bike? I mean, what are the kind of excuses people make, especially the folks that you work with in your coaching, you know, in terms of their fitness? What are the kind of the roadblocks that they face?
I think one of the things is actually being able to manage the intensities. So, if you know, it depends on what you're training for. And it also depends on your lifestyle and what it is that you're doing. So one thing that I do like to say is that you can make improvements even if you have limited time, even if you are kind of time crunched. But a lot of the time it's not about forcing it. It's about riding at lower intensities. that's really tricky to do when you mountain bike, because when you go mountain biking, the power file is going to be, it's like a saw blade, you know, it's up and down, up and down, up and down. So it's like a lot of European mountain bike racers will do a lot of the road riding on their mountain bike, or they'll do gravel road riding or dirt road stuff. And I guess it's just making sure that you don't have to ride a road bike. I'm not going to say to anyone you have to ride a road bike, but it's like choose your routes. You know, you put a bit of planning and thought into the route that you're going to ride. And if your goal is to do a 2 hour or a 1 hour steady endurance ride, kind of keeping your heart rate below 75% and really doing some good quality aerobic endurance conditioning, pick a route that's going to let you do that. So you're going to have to just be, you can't have too many steep hills. You just got to, or if you've got, you need to make sure you've got the right kind of gear in if you're going to be doing steep hills and having the discipline to hold yourself back when you're riding up the hills, because it's really difficult to believe that riding slowly is going to make you faster. But it's tried and tested and proven. You know, it's a big part of any kind of endurance training, and even riding downhill. You know, it's a 4 minute event. It's still very much endurance. You know, there's going to be a big aerobic contribution to a downhill rider. I'm not saying it's all aerobic, but there will be a big contribution of that is going to be aerobic. So best way to do that is ride as much as you can, nice and easy,
keeping it steady. I mean, that's huge. Like, I mean, you summed it up really well for me, because I think I had that kind of confusion about it too. You know, like 2 hours on a bike is 2 hours on a bike, but you know, if you think about a mountain bike ride, it is like that. It's kind of that whipsaw where it's very intense for a short period, and then there's a rest, and then, you know, it's just kind of up and down. Whereas on a road bike, it's much more steady.
Yeah. And like, you know, those mountain bike rides where you go up and down there, you know, and you do have to ride hard, they're great too, you know. It's great to do them. But if all your rides are like that, you're gonna burn out probably. And again, it's like, yes, it's having if you've got a plan and you know what, if you know where you're going and you know where you're starting from, you can make the plan to fit your goals and try and achieve what you're looking to achieve. If you just go out riding all the time, you know, it's loads of fun. You know, it's great to just get out and have a blast and kind of rip up the hill, up and down the hills sometimes. But, you know, you have to, I guess there's going to be a bit of give and take. You're going to have to try and fit in those rides. One thing, one of the general rules I really like for keeping your endurance rides right are that a friend of mine, Nick Craig, is a mountain bike Olympian. He rode Sydney Olympics, and he's basically just known as a real mountain bike legend in the UK. He's still a fantastic rider. You know, I'm going to say the wrong age here, but I'm sure I think he might be over 50 and he still rips elite races.
Wow.
he tears them to pieces. And one of his things when he does his endurance rides is he just talks about nose breathing. If you have to open your mouth to breathe, you're going too hard. And it's like, it's simple, but it's effective. It's a good one to go. So if you're doing your endurance rides, see how, you know, try and see when do you have to open your mouth to start to pant, or can you do the whole thing breathing out your nose? And you've got to keep pedaling as well. You're not allowed to just freewheel everywhere.
Right.
You got to be pedaling.
That's a good one. I'm going to have to try that. That's good.
Yeah. Give it a try. If you've got a heart rate monitor, keep an eye on it as well and see what things are saying. It's okay to open your mouth every now and again, though. I don't want anybody suffocating. It's a nice little trick.
Well, what are your plans for 2021? Are there other FKT attempts you have your sights set on, or are you looking forward to maybe getting back to in-person racing?
Yeah, that's a good question. What are the plans for 2021? It's so hard to plan at the moment. And the one, I think probably the biggest plan is for me to not lose the fitness gains that I got this year. I really enjoyed I fell in love with training again. I was really enjoying it, and it was great to be working towards a goal, and to have the time to actually be able to train for it was brilliant this year. So that is definitely top of the list, is to maintain or even build on what I've achieved this year in terms of fitness. In terms of FKTs, I think that will be decided on what events we have this year. So I do really want to get back to in-person racing. I've got a vague, fairly vague goal of riding the Andalusia bike race in April in Spain, which isn't set in stone and isn't certain, but I'm hoping to go to ride that with Mark Scott, who's a professional mountain biker in Scotland. He's ridden the Enduro World Series, the downhill enduro racing. He's a former downhill World Cup racer, but he's really fallen in love with riding, you know, big cross country epics, and he's done some crazy big rides this year. So I was hoping to get out to Andalusia. It's a pairs stage race, and it's a round of the UCI Mountain Bike Marathon World Series. I think it's a 6-day race. So potentially aiming for that. The British Cross Country Mountain Bike Series dates have been announced as well. So I've got them in my diary. I think I'll go back doing some cross country racing. And I think the UCI Mountain Bike Marathon Series is just been announced. The UCI announced it a couple of months ago. So it's a series of there's two stage races, the Cape Epic and Andalusia, and then a number of one-day races as well. So if I can make those happen, if we can make any of those happen, that would be it. The Cape Epic is still on my bucket list. I rode it in 2014 and I had to pull out on the final day with health issues. I actually got stretchered out of the place, but it was a... Yeah, it's one thing I need to go back and kind of tick that one off the bucket list. So I'm not sure when, but hopefully that'll happen one day as well.
Yeah, right on. Well, thank you, Rab, for taking the time to talk. And I've really enjoyed it. And best of luck to you next year.
Thank you very much.
Well, you can keep up with Rab on his website, rabwardell.com. And we'll have that link in the show notes. That's all we've got this week. We'll talk to you again next week.